not finished races well in the past are going to do it today. Here they come another time.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Mark Rogers. I'm the host of the
F1 Fan for Years.
F1Weekly.com podcast.
We're going to do tire changes maybe next year. I think
Hi, this is Desiree. I'm your fabulous, fierce female Formula One fan.
Fisichella, bravo!
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. This is podcast number 1111, September 8th, 2025. Stephen.
This is F1Weekly Podcast. It's brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads get you the F1Weekly.com website for the ads that interest you. From cars to car parts, Yahoo Ads gets you everything that you could possibly want. Click on them. You know you want to.
Thank you, Steve. And thank you, Yahoo Ads. Wow, wasn't that the coolest retro intro ever? On today's program, Max's pole, the fastest lap in Formula One history. Amazing average speed, 264 kph. Amazing, absolutely amazing. The McLaren Love Fest continues with lesson in fairness. Lots of love, and everybody gets a trophy at McLaren. Colton Herta signed on for Cadillac. A good idea or a bad idea? And on this week's Nasser Hamid Corner, we've got Bobby Unser and part two of the John Edwards interview from Laguna Seca. And yes, indeed, we do need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab on the front page. You know you'll want to. Wow. Monza, my favorite. Nasser loved Monza. Monza is just too wonderful. So fast and so exciting. And apparently, Max had a double espresso. So, unbelievable. The fastest race in Formula One history. The fastest lap in Formula One history. And it's good that these cars are doing that as they end their era. But nevertheless, a fantastic Grand Prix. A great start. A classic. Max Verstappen start. Cuts the chicane. And this time with our new team principal, Mekies doesn't mess around, tells him right away, you must give the spot back. He does. And of course, lap four, Max, who found so much speed in this car with the low downforce setup, it was no problem. He repasses Norris, and there you have it. And there you go. History is made with this fantastic Grand Prix. Poor Fernando suffering again. But a little bit of chaos on the start. Really, I thought it was a clean start for most people. And, you know, and let's talk about qualifying real quickly. The games Sainz was playing with the Racing Bulls, I think, was unprofessional. I know he's stuck at Williams now, and life is going to be frustrating for a long, long time. But I am really surprised he didn't get a penalty for that. They explained the penalty for Lewis Hamilton, and I concur. He was ridiculously too fast in the double yellow and certainly should have gotten a penalty for Holland at Holland, 10 seconds, but not to throw it at him at Monza. Could you imagine how exciting that would have been without the penalty, because Lewis Hamilton was very racy. And of course, Leclerc was super racy. It was exciting, but Piastri had to take care of business. But of course, it's Monza. It's so fast. NASCAR loved this race. It was done in an hour and 15 minutes, and that was it. I mean, and really very disappointing because Aston Martin had really great pace for a while there. I'm not sure, but the rumble strips on the chicanes are pretty rough there, and poor Fernando, man, he was not a happy camper. He came in, well, he left Holland not a happy camper, so I don't know how Fernando keeps going, but I'm thinking as long as there's Lewis, we will have a Fernando. But nevertheless, Max definitely pulled off the race of his career with these fantastic laps. It was impressive. I'm very impressed with the McLarens. Outstanding. There's just too much love at McLaren. And I find that very interesting under Zach Brown, who's really a ruthless guy. You don't get to the top by being lovey-dovey. But we're watching this play out, and I find it very, very fascinating. Also, I want to talk Colton Herta going to Cadillac real quickly before we get into our big interview. Colton Herta going to Cadillac, it's the smartest thing he could do. He's 26 years old. You can languish an IndyCar until you're in your early or late 40s. Look at Will Power, who now is signed again for an 18th season at Andretti, where Colton will be leaving and going to Cadillac as a test driver. Very smart. I think it's going to give him some exposure to real racing, real technology. And I don't mean to diminish IndyCar, but I think this is going to be good for his future. I think it's just going to be a great experience. And we never know. Maybe he will be fantastic in Formula One. So I'm really happy about this. Always like to see somebody from the United States try to make it in Formula One. We've had Scott Speed, and we had Logan Sargeant. So I think now we've got a really seasoned, proven race winner in Indy. I think he could do a lot of good. And I think he could be very helpful in putting the team together. So there you have it. The love fest of McLaren is not going to stop. I really enjoyed the answer that Piastri threw out there when he was told to give up the position to Norris because Norris had an unfair slow stop, and we're all love and festive over here at McLaren. So his answer was perfect. He knew that pit stops were part of racing, and too bad for Norris, but that's the way it is. They're fair and square over there. So we'll see how that turns up the heat later on when we really have to kick some ass. So there you go. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, on today's NASCAR Amid Corner, we're still digging way, way deep. And now, more Laguna Seca, because NASCAR always went there at least twice a year for IndyCar, for the Motorsports Reunion, sometimes for IMSA. This particular week in May of 2007, he got Bobby Unser, which is an outstanding interview. These guys are made for each other. It's just a motorsports love fest. And, of course, part two of John Edwards, who's a very young American driver who obviously never made it to Formula One, but he's so eloquent. He does such a good interview that I could see why NASCAR went to him several times, because it was an easy interview. It was always a good interview, informative. So there you go. Let's not forget that we have Baku coming up. And things are going to change, I think, at McLaren. This love fest cannot last forever. Trust me. So anyway, enjoy the interviews. Have a great weekend. And we'll see you next week.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the king, the Swami himself, Nasser Hamid.
Greetings and racing regards to all the listeners from Bangor to Bangladesh. And folks, after this program and the Motorsports Mondial, we have an in-depth conversation with Bobby Unser, one of the great racing legends this country has produced, winner at Indy 500 and Pikes Peak. So please stay tuned after Motorsports Mondial. Hello, this is Andrew with this week's F1Weekly.com trivia question. This weekend sees the running of the Turkish Grand Prix. The Istanbul Park circuit shares an interesting trait in common with the Interlagos circuit in Brazil and the Imola circuit in Italy. What do you think these three circuits have in common? And I'll be back later in the show with the answer.
Welcome back to F1 Weekly. Steve Faub, your host, sitting in for Clark Rogers. I'm joined by Nasser Hamid, our historical correspondents. And now we spin the globe. And where it stops, only Nasser knows, with Motorsports Mondial.
Well, it stops at Laguna Seca. I was there this past weekend for the Monterey Historics. Had a great time. But, you know, I don't know how many of our listeners are. I'm sure quite a few of them are missing Clark Rogers. So I'm pleased to confirm Mr. Rogers will be returning soon from his trip to NASCAR Nation, i.e. Florida. And I'm sure he will have some juicy stories. Yeah, Laguna Seca was fun. I was there all weekend. Huge, huge crowd on Saturday. Very impressive.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and I was able to, you know, and when you go to a major event, this is the problem, curse of a big event. You have a lot of PR people and, you know, like gatekeepers. And I was able to track down Emerson Fittipaldi three times. He was willing to talk to me, but his PR people won't let me, not his, but, you know, people who are organizing this thing.
Yeah, they probably already had appointments booked all the way
through
the weekend.
Yeah, and, you know, it's all, everything is just in time, you know.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, man, I was so impressed by meeting him and talking to him. Within a minute, I realized why this man is so popular worldwide. I mean, just like a average guy, very nice. I mean, he looks at my F1 Weekly card and he says, Nasir, you must be from Pakistan. And I says, wow, I'm impressed. How did you know that? He said, oh, I have a lot of friends from Pakistan, Lebanon, and Brazil. So, you know, just tells you the guy is an educated, smart guy. And then I was also able to, again, it took a few attempts to track down Ove Anderson. He was head of Toyota Motorsports. And I wanted to talk to him because both him and Fittipaldi were at the top of their games when I started really following motorsports 30 years ago, 30 plus years ago. But I could not get a lot of time with them. But Bobby Unser was available.
Yeah.
And actually, he tracked me down and he goes, hey, you want to do that interview now? And had a very good time with him. And did a lot of stories with Bobby Unser. Anytime you talk to the old guard, you know. And another gentleman I met is Phil Remington. Phil Remington is people in American racing who are in the industry. He is one of the most respected men. He was with, he has been with Dan Gurney for over three decades. He was involved in the Ford Le Mans program, the GT program. And that's a 5-8 minute, I think a 5-minute interview, but a lot of information there. So hopefully we'll put them,
we'll get them on in the shows in the upcoming weeks.
Yeah. And, the Bobby Unser is on today's show. So hopefully people will enjoy that. Now we'll take a quick look at some historical events this week in motor racing history. And because of time constraint, just a few items, but important. August 22nd, Bremgarten, 1954. Juan Manuel Fangio wins his second world championship at the Swiss Grand Prix. August 23rd, 1987, French driver Didier Pironi killed along with two other people during a powerboat race off the Isle of Wight in England. And next week we'll do a tribute to Didier Pironi. Famously remembered for the incident with Villeneuve at Imola in 1982. August 25th, 1991, Spa-Francorchamps. Shot that was heard and felt around the world for many, many seasons. The dramatic debut in a beautiful green 7-Up sponsored Jordan car. How I wish Clark Rogers was here today. Man at the wheel, Michael Schumacher from Kirpin, Germany, who would drive the intensity and desire of Ayrton Senna into the 21st century. Need I say more? Danke schön. Thank you for the memories. And finally, Mark Webber from Australia celebrates his 31st birthday on August 27th, and we wish him an extra shrimp on the Barbie, along with, you know, supersized case of Fosters, Australian for beer.
And a good weekend in Turkey.
Oh, yeah. Let's hope he's a leg up on DC.
And now, Naz, how about a introduction to your wonderful interview.
Mr. Bobby Unser. Bobby Unser is quite a character. He has been in the news, for many years. Tremendous racing talent, American legend, three-time winner of the Indy 500, and also winner at Pikes Peak. And, you know, surprisingly, interestingly, he made his Grand Prix debut in the same race as Mario Andretti, the 1968 U.S. Grand Prix at Watkins Glen. And they were the best of friends, and then, you know, came the Indy 500 of 1981 and the hotly disputed to this day result, which went in Bobby's Unser's favor, very rightly so, because he won the race on the track, and that's the way races should be won. It was very nice talking to him, you know, very big name, very successful family, and he shares his thought on his competition, what his goals were in Formula One, and what he's doing these days. He's a very busy man, and like he told me, lived all my life in New Mexico. So I would like to thank him for his time and his input into the world of motor racing, as he has seen from his own experience. And I did ask him who was a better driver between him and Al Unser Sr., and he said he thinks he's a better driver. So we'll check with Al Sr. next time. So Mr. Bobby Unser, thank you very much, sir, and we'll talk to you soon in the near future.
Okay, I'm here with one and only Bobby Unser, a great American legend. Bobby, you started your career in roadsters, front engine, then you saw Jim Clark and Colin Chapman came here, and then came the young guns, Rick Mears, Michael Andretti. Racing changed a lot in that time frame. What were the changes that you liked, and what were the changes that you did not like?
Well, the changes that I liked was that there was a lot of innovations in those days, and you could dream up an idea, think of one, make it, develop it, and have something over the other cars. And that was just the 60s and the 70s was of course the golden years of racing, and it was world over, not just the United States. And unfortunately, then they started getting so much technology, the rules makers couldn't keep up with the engineers, and cars are becoming spec cars. And that's what's sad. Computers have taken over the drivers. The drivers are becoming less heroes. The engineers and the computers are becoming the heroes, and the people don't like it. The fans don't like it. And that's the part I don't like.
Now, talking about engineering, I've spoken to some people for whom you drove, team members, and they always said that you were a very hands-on kind of driver. Did you drive team owners and members crazy?
I absolutely did, but it wasn't in a bad way. I mean, I made race cars go fast. I became a self-taught engineer, and I became quite good at it. And I always did my own chassis setups. I never trusted somebody else, and it wasn't that you had distrust in your mechanics. It's just that if you had hands-on, and then you drove the car, then you really knew what was better or what was worse and why it was better or worse. So I think that was largely some of the advantages that I had for a lot of years. And still today when I do things.
Who were some of your toughest competitors?
Oh, the whole bunch of them. Gosh, I'd have to have an old list. But let me just look at my brother and Foyt. And of course, Parnelli, who's here today, is the one that took me to Indianapolis and made a lot of my opportunities available for me. But there were so many guys, Mario, Roger McCluskey, Don Branson. I mean, I don't know. I'd have some old books to go back and tell you they were tough race drivers.
Your most memorable wins, and also some of the races where you did not win, but you were proud of your, drive that day.
Well, I had lots of those. But you must remember that I did hundreds and hundreds of races. And so you can't just pick out one that was your most memorable. And if you did, it would obviously be one that a person won, like my first Indy race, like my first Pikes Peak win, stuff like that. First wins are always the most important for everybody.
Now, you drove for Roger Penske and Dan Gurney, two great American names. Very different people also. Can you tell a little bit about your experience for these driving for these people?
Well, first of all, Dan, I was with Dan Gurney a long time, and I was a development driver, plus the guy that was supposed to win a lot of races, and I did. And we had good cars. And my experiences with Dan were very good. He never had enough money, but he always had fast cars. And with the exception, with a few exceptions, we won a lot of races with Dan. And the people that he had were such good people. In other words, it really furthered my engineering abilities and my capabilities. I did so much development work for him. And of course, that was a big highlight up to its day. But then, later on, in came Roger Penske. Well, Roger just gave me the whole thing. Whatever I wanted, I had. And money was never a problem anymore. And don't care what I wanted to try, don't care what I wanted to experiment with. Didn't make any difference. He never said no. And Roger used to tell me, I'm right probably 75% of the time, so he's never going to say no. I tested where I wanted to. I did as much testing as I wanted. If I wanted to have new pieces built, he didn't care who did it or where it came from. All he wanted was the race cars to go fast. And what Roger did is he took the excuses for losing out of the whole thing. So there was only winning that's left. And of course, that's what I was after and that's what I wanted too. So, you know, nobody thought that Roger and I would get along. And I was probably one of those. But in all the years, I did four cars for Roger, developed. And almost 100% no arguments. In other words, we really, 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 and when things did go wrong, which they do occasionally, Roger was the first guy there to help. He didn't care where it was. What can I do to help? Sometimes he'd have a tie on, sometimes a suit. He'd take off his tie and the jacket, he'd be in there working. I have a picture, Milwaukee. Things really went bad that day. My spare car wasn't race ready. And the first one, we blew up the tub by accident. So I had to take the spare car, and it had to be set up fast and furious. And we only had probably 30, 45 minutes to set that car up. And Roger and I did most of it ourselves. And we didn't argue. We just meticulously worked at the car. And by golly, I went good in the race.
Very impressive. Now, who was a better driver, Bobby Unser or Al Unser Sr.?
Well, I don't know. You know, I can't say anything bad about my brother because he won an awful lot of races. If you ever had Al in the right car with the right team, untouchable. I mean, Al never made mistakes. He never drove too hard, but he drove hard enough to win. And you just look at his record. It's a fabulous record. I still think I'm a better driver.
Good for you. Who won the 1981 Indy 500? You or Mario Andretti?
Well, Mario damn sure didn't win it. And if anybody thinks they do, just look at the race and see.
Okay. Now, recently, Jack Aru did a very good program, I believe, on Speed TV, 1 hour between you and Mario on this issue. Is the dispute resolved? Are you friends with Mario now?
Well, unfortunately, and I mean really mean, unfortunately, he used to be one of my very closest friends until he got to thinking that he won the 81 Indy race. And of course, that was all because of trying to say that I violated the rules, and yet he did the same thing. And once we got pictures of it and showed it and everything, what else can he say? And plus, it wasn't a violation of the rules anyway. Otherwise, USAC would have never given it back to me, I promise you.
But do you guys talk now or what?
No, we don't, and that's the part that I said was very unfortunate.
Yeah, you guys are great heroes. It's very sad.
Well, it's more than sad. If you knew what good friends we were before, then you'd know how sad it really is to me. And it'll always be sad and over something that wasn't his, over something that was mine. To lose a friendship isn't that sad.
Both of you made your Formula One debut at Watkins Glen in 1968. How was driving a Formula One car compared to Indy cars? And did you have any desire to pursue a Formula One career?
Well, in the beginning of my career, if you want to call it that, way many years ago, road racing is what I truly wanted to do. But I couldn't make it there, meaning I couldn't get rides. You had to be a little bit comfortable with the money. You had to have ways to get there. And I didn't have any money and no way to get to that. So when in 1968, when I had a chance to drive the BRM, I didn't think the car was as bad as it was, and I went for it. Turns out it was a terrible year for BRM, but I still wanted to do Formula One, and thank God I got to do at least a little bit of it.
How was that car compared to your IndyCar of those days?
A piece of junk. I mean, the Formula One car was just a piece of junk. BRM just wasn't a good car that year. And also, I found out that Formula One was extremely political. In other words, it was so political, it's unbelievable. Even in our own team. Because I think, if I remember right, Pedro Rodriguez, who was a good friend of mine, was my teammate. And I wrecked the car at Watkins Glen and got into the spare car and found out that engine ran so much better than mine. And I never forgot that. That was all politics within our own team. And that was so sad. Now, in American racing, you normally don't have that happen. Usually, guys are on the same team, get equal brakes, equal cars, equal engines, things like that. Formula One, in those days, was really different that way.
It's still very political. Let me
just add to that. Look at Michael Andretti when he went back there. Problem with Michael is he wanted to live in the United States. He was a good race driver, incidentally. Totally capable. But he went over there with a wife that nobody liked. He went over there with a bad attitude. In other words, his daddy was a European. And they accepted Mario over there. But they never accepted Michael, so he could never overcome the bad politics in Formula One.
Talking of politics, what is your take on the IndyCar split, you know, Champ Cars and IRL? It's been very damaging to open-wheel racing in America. What's your take on that?
It's sad, and it's bad, and it's wrong, and it totally killed it. You know, we used to be so far ahead of NASCAR, and now I'm not knocking NASCAR, so don't misunderstand what I'm saying. NASCAR puts on a good show, but there's no technology there at all. It's totally the press rights about what they do to want to talk about to make them high-tech cars. There's no technology. They basically made the same frame for probably 40 or 50 years. It's a good show, but what they did is took the wars that we had in the Indy cars and they started marketing really good during those times. Now, the other thing, and I know some of the readers won't like it, but we don't have any American drivers in Indy cars anymore. To speak of, we just have none. And they all go to NASCAR. That's where the money is now. And I don't blame them for that. But isn't it sad that we don't, all we have is what we call foreign drivers. Now, that being said, they're very good drivers. I mean, the guys, I always used to say when I drove, it didn't make any difference what color a man was, what kind of language that he spoke. Human beings are human beings, and talent comes from wherever you find it. And so I'm not against the foreign drivers in any manner, shape, or form. But they've totally taken over because they're raised in rear-engine cars. Our guys are raised in stock cars now. So we've got a terrible imbalance in the United States. Now, that being said, the next thing where the problem is that when Roger Penske sold out all the racetracks that he owned, he sold them all to NASCAR. That buried open-wheel racing. Now, they should take care of it because all racing needs to keep going. But it doesn't. In fact, for the most part, it's gone downhill, as you well know. It's not all just the war between old CART and IRL, what's called Champ Car now. That's not the entirety of it. The entirety is simply that NASCAR owns everything. For example, at Fontana, California, we used to have races there, and it was nothing to have the grandstands full. I did the television there, I remember. And as soon as Penske sold all of his racetracks to NASCAR, I mean, they got down to where they were probably only having 10,000 spectators at a racetrack where you should have 100,000. Now, that is NASCAR not allowing, or its people not doing the marketing that they should be doing to keep all racing going. It's happened at Phoenix, it's happened at Fontana, it's happened at many of the racetracks because they're basically all owned by NASCAR now. And I really think that Mike Kelton That's about all that's left in NASCAR that's doing any good. I think you ought to take a look at this and try to realize that the world can't accept NASCAR as being the only racing organization. But they are number one today, whether we like it or not. And they're doing a good, good, good job of marketing.
Okay, do you have a magic solution to the open wheel split?
Do what?
A magic wand you can, you know, like, fly it over and solve the issue. What would it take to solve the IndyCar split?
Well, it won't be one magic wand, I promise you. You have extremely, and when I say extremely, I'm talking about extreme rich people on both sides of the fence. Now, I know they wouldn't like to hear this, but probably they will. But unfortunately, they're too stubborn. Tony George doesn't have to ask anybody anything, no matter what kind of a mistake he makes. It'll be covered up from the mass of money in owning the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Now, with the other people over on Champ Car side, same answer. It's not paying its way, and it isn't growing. There are no Americans, basically, in the entire series. It's a foreign series that runs in foreign countries for the most part. Nobody has any television stuff. It's so low, you can't even tell what a rating is. And yet they have good races. But see, the American fans can't equate to guys that they can't pronounce the names of. And when they hear them talk on television, they don't understand some of the stuff that they say. And what it is in NASCAR, all of those guys, back to that again, they all come from the local tracks, from New York, from Philadelphia, from California, from Oklahoma, wherever, and they all speak English, and they all come from local racing organizations. So that makes the American thing grow bigger and bigger and bigger, which, unfortunately, is all NASCAR. So what's the magic wand for fixing it? First place, Tony George is going to ultimately be the winner. And he has to be, because he owns the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So no matter what Tony says, it's going to be right because he owns the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And the family can't go broke. They have too much money. So therefore, I don't think he's fixing things as good as he should or could. But are they putting on good racing? Yes. But it's back to what we first started talking about. It's a spec series. There are no innovations left. Like somebody said the other day when we were talking, if you took the paint jobs off the cars, you couldn't tell any difference in any manner, shape, or form. And the rules are down to being spec rules so tight that nobody can wiggle anymore. No driver can try something different. The computers have totally taken over the driver's voices. A lot of the teams today in IndyCar racing don't even talk to their drivers anymore. They read the computers and make the decisions. The driver just simply drives the car. And they've got it so good today that they can usually drive flat out no matter where they are. Now, this is not what the fans want. The American racing fan wants to see the driver do something. They want to see him try hard, work hard. But I'm not talking about work hard with the computer. I'm talking about work hard. Talk to the mechanics. Do you know how long it's been that a mechanic in IndyCar racing has even looked at a spark plug? Doesn't happen anymore. They don't touch the engines. They take them out and they put a new one in. That's the most work they do on that. The rest of it is all just putting the chassis pieces together, and the computers tell them everything. I think this is hurting racing. And I've always thought so. Well, always, meaning in the modern times here.
Now, what is a day in the life of Bobby Unser these days? Do you have any involvement in racing these days?
No, I don't. And I really don't want any. I'm not against racing. I love it. You can tell the way I'm having fun here at Laguna Seca.
But and talking to me.
That's right. And I really get up talking to somebody like you because you're asking the types of questions that I like to vent. I like to tell people my feelings because I think they're right. But I do. Ironically, I still have to have challenges in life. Everybody should, and I certainly do. And what I do is I do a lot of litigation work and accident reconstruction with cars. As I told you earlier, I'm a self-taught engineer. So therefore, I mean, like with Chrysler, I've done some humongously big cases with Chrysler, and I love it. Because when somebody says there's something wrong with the car, I can tell them why there isn't something wrong, or why an accident happened, or why it shouldn't have happened, or if the car got too high a CG. There's many things that just go right in the line of work that I've done all my life.
As a big racing fan, I definitely want to see another Unser winning races. Who is in the family that can take the challenge like you and Al Senior did and Junior?
Unfortunately, it doesn't look good right now. We're looking to it skipping another generation. I'm sad to say little Al's son isn't going to be a race driver, or he may dabble in it, but he just won't make it. We have some grandkids that may or may not, but who knows? Racing takes so much dedication. If you read the last book that I wrote, you'll see that I really truly believe that desire is the root of everything that comes good in this world. And if you don't have the desire to want to do something, and you don't really want to risk everything that there is in this world to be a race driver, you're not going to make a good one, whether the computer is helping you or whether you're doing it on your own. You really have to have the desire to step out and do it. It isn't an easy life, but I truly think it was a good life. I wish I had a time machine and I could do it again. I just really wish I could.
Now, what would be one race or one event, again, going back to one thing, that if you could do it again, that you would say, hey, I'd like to run that race again?
Well, I had lots of them. I had numerous IndyCar races or Indianapolis races that I should have and could have won. Mechanical problems just whipped me on them. And some people back in those days said I was too hard on the car. But I don't think I was. I was paid to go fast, and that's what I did. And in 79 with Roger Penske, I led most of the race. I had that thing totally put away and really, really, really was going to win it. And the fourth gear in the transmission broke. Now, that's one gear that never breaks in a race car, the top gear. And it broke. So that means that the good Lord had something to do with that. He just said, Bobby, you ran good today, but you're not going to win this race. And that was really sad. But I can't remember many races that I drove for Roger Penske that I shouldn't have or couldn't have won. So that's a motivator beyond belief.
I've got to ask you a question about Roger Penske. Here is a guy who was so successful, so rich, so many businesses. How does he find time to be at a NASCAR race, sports car race, dirt race, all in one weekend?
I don't know. I think if we knew the truth, if we were there or could be in his pocket, I think he's bit off more than he needs to chew right now. I really believe that. I know Roger so well because, for five or four cars, I practically lived with the man. And, I know how he thinks. I know how he moves. I know what he's going to do and everything like that. And Roger is really funny. If he has a little bit of success in this series, he'll go to another one, still staying in the other series. And it's typically the way he does it. He likes racing so much that he wants to win in everything. I'm surprised he hasn't gotten a sprint car or a midget because he's never ran those or wanted to win in those. But, you don't find guys with that type of desire. And I've often thought about Roger that the money he makes, and we all know he makes a lot of money. I think a lot of it is predicated on the fact that he's got to have the racing deal, and he needs that money to keep racing. And that's something you have to really take your head off to the guy for.
Now, you certainly have a lot of passion for Indy 500, like I do too. If you could go back in time and be a team owner, not a race car driver, because you've seen them all, and you were to pick a couple of drivers as... if they were all available in prime time of their career, who would those two drivers be?
Obviously, I'd pick my brother because he was easy on race cars and he could go fast. I'd pick Mario Andretti. I'd pick Parnelli Jones. But I knew so many other ones that were so good. Honest to goodness, had they been engineering, mechanical-wise, like I thought that I was, or learned... Roger McCluskey, Don Branson, I could just go on down the road. They were great drivers, but often they weren't mechanics, and they couldn't do the little things that they could do to help themselves win a race. But even at that, they still won a lot of races. So I saw bunches of what I considered the very best.
Your thoughts on people like newer generation, Rick Mears, Danny Sullivan?
Rick Mears was obviously very similar to my brother Al. Rick was easy on race cars. He could get speed out of them. And he totally fit Roger Penske's concepts and the way Roger worked. But look at Rick's career. All his wins were with one car owner. Okay? Mine weren't. Al's weren't. Parnelli's weren't. Foyt's weren't. Just think about what I'm saying. Rick was very, very smart. Opportunity happened because he met Roger Penske. They got along good, and he stayed right where he was. And that shows that Rick was very smart. But I'd sure like to see him drive a few more race cars for other people, see?
Finally, how about a message for listeners of F1 Weekly? We have a worldwide audience.
Well, I think your stuff is very good. I think people should like racing, and I know they do. And I just think racing is a neat thing, and I hope that people never get tired of it, never lose faith in it, and always realize that, come on, it's got to be a man and a machine, and men against men, not computers. But keep watching and listening to what you do.
How about men against Danica?
Well, that's good, but you know something about Danica, if you don't mind my mentioning. The girl, every once in a while you see an exception. Okay, I mean, Michelle Mouton, I used to say, there was a girl, I watched her run, she was extremely good, and the only girl that I saw in my whole career that I thought was truly a race car driver. But now Danica came along, 105, 110 pounds, and she, honest to goodness, has got talent beyond belief. But more than talent, she has desire. She really wants to go fast. She really wants to win. And I hope she gets the opportunity, meaning all the little things that go together to help you win a race. And luck is one of them, as we both know.
Bobby Unser, thanks again. I hope you enjoyed this conversation.
Well, I really enjoyed this conversation because, number one, I think you asked better questions than anybody from the press that I've talked to in years. I mean, good questions, and hopefully you got some good answers out of it, at least my true feelings.
Great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Unser, and we'll be back after these brief messages.
And here's this week's F1Weekly.com trivia answer. The Istanbul Park, Interlagos, and Imola circuits all share one thing in common. The races are run in an anti-clockwise direction. Okay, that's it for this week. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again next week. Bye now.
My name is Tuukka Taponen, and I'm listening F1 Weekly.
Here's part two of the John Edwards interview.
Now, are you still in that program?
I'm out of Red Bull right now, and they are sort of aiming more towards Europe, and I'm staying in America and hoping to run Atlantics again. So we've parted company for now, but who knows what's going to happen in the future.
Now, you raced Atlantics last year. How old were you last year, and how did you find what was the biggest adjustment for you racing here in the U.S. against a different level of competition?
The biggest adjustment for me, and I was 16 last year in Atlantics, and the biggest adjustment was just getting used to the car, really, because the competition is about the same, and, you know, Europe's very competitive, but of course, as everyone knows, Atlantics is a very competitive series. So the one rule that's difficult to get used to is the blocking rule, because in Europe you can block as much as you want, and here there's the blocking rule is that there is none. You cannot block, you cannot alter your line, so it's a little difficult to find out, you know, well, can you bend that a little bit, and can you how much can you really take from that? So that was the toughest thing for me to get used to in a racing situation.
Your dad is a lawyer, right?
No, my dad's a doctor.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that, because if you were 16 last year, you're 17, still underage. I hope I don't get a letter from somebody, hey, why are you talking to teenagers?
Well, if you have a restraining order or anything I need to know about, you should let me know now so we can get this interview over with.
No, I'm clean. You can check with the Homeland Security. Okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate your season last year?
Last year was probably only a 6 or a 7. You know, it was a very up and down year for me because I had, you know, one good results with, or a couple good results, but one podium in Toronto. And I set the record. I was the youngest to ever do so. But then again, anything I did last year, I was the youngest to do. So when I crashed out, I was the youngest to crash out. And when I finished fifth, I was the youngest to do that too. So it was.
So it's like Michael Schumacher and Alonso. Whatever you do, you're going in the record books.
Just about. But unfortunately, that also goes for the bad stuff too. So unfortunately, I just had an up and down season, and I'm hoping I can come back this year and have a more consistent on the top of the sheets year.
Let me ask you a question. You know, it's a serious question now. You're very young, and you've gone through. You raced in here, you went overseas, you came back here. If you were to look back at your career, would you do something differently? And what I'm trying to find out, do you think you jumped into a series faster than you should have?
A lot of people have asked me that, and I don't think I did.
I thought I was the first genius.
First genius or just a genius?
Just a genius. Why not?
Yeah. No, that was... it was definitely interesting getting up into the series as young as I was, but I learned a lot, and unfortunately, just, you know, to put on a resume that you did all this stuff, you know, all I can say is that I was young and I was still learning and on a big curve and into a series a lot younger than most of the people and a lot more inexperienced than most of the people I was racing against. So from the aspect of, you know, talking about results and everything, I would like to have said, you know, well, I won this championship and I did this, but for me, it was all about learning, and so I got to move up and was just fortunate enough to have that opportunity to experience things at a very young age. So I wouldn't change that. I would definitely keep it the same. You know, there's pros and cons to it, but I feel like I learned a lot from that.
Now, sponsorship and everything in America now is gravitating toward NASCAR. How do you find the search for sponsorship in America for road racing?
The search for sponsorship has never been easy. It doesn't matter what's happened lately or what's happened in the past few years. It's always been a difficult battle. And, you know, right now I don't have any sponsors, but I'm hoping to get a free ride in Atlantics or at least a partially funded ride. And it's all about, you know, putting together anything you can and finding any sort of money you can from small companies that can give you a little bit to, you know, big companies like Red Bull who can fund you for 3 years like they did with me, and it's all very tough, but it's been the same. It's been like this for years.
Now, obviously, you know, you're trying to get into Atlantics. Are you open to some other series?
Well, right now I'm looking at Atlantics, and it's so late that other series have already started, and I've been testing Atlantics. I have experience in the car, so the fact that I'm not driving at this test doesn't mean a lot for me. Obviously, you want as much seat time as you can get, but it doesn't mean a lot for me. If I were to go to a new series, I would be at a huge disadvantage because I haven't had any time in the car, and it would be a long time, and I would have to spend the first few races learning to drive that particular car. So I don't want to do that, but I really want to be in a race car this year, and I'm open to a lot of options.
Well, wish you all the best. Last season, what were the highs and the lows for you?
The best race I had was finishing second at Toronto. It was a downpour at the race, and it was really pretty scary when you're driving down the straightaway, and I know I was in third, and I couldn't see anything, so I know the guys in 15th to 20th could see even less than I could. And you're doing, 150 miles an hour, and you can't see anything, so it was pretty cool to finish on the podium in such stressful conditions. But the low was definitely Road America, because it started with a high when I qualified on provisional pole and started second for the race, and ended horribly when I went off on the second lap and all on my own, just made a mistake and carried too much speed into turn one and went at a wild ride through the gravel and came back on. I finished eighth, but that was definitely a lost podium for me, and that was all my fault. So that was the worst part of my season.
Who's your man in Formula One?
I try to follow Formula One without actually rooting for them, although last year I was definitely hoping Hamilton would win the championship just to show Alonso, you know. He came in and thought his teammate, you know, was a rookie and he would definitely beat him, and I was really thought it was cool when Hamilton was faster than his teammate, but it was a great year just to watch, and I hope this year is about the same.
And what do you think of Kimi Raikkonen?
Kimi's a very good driver, and
you know, he's so focused on racing, he hardly ever says anything.
I don't know if that's because of his focus on racing or if he just doesn't say anything, but
focus on maybe something else.
Yeah. No, Kimi's a very good driver, and he gets a lot of blame for things because he likes to go out and party. But I say, hey, if he wins a championship and he still likes to party, you can't blame him for that.
Okay, please tell our listeners your website so they can follow your career.
My website is www.johnmichaeledwards.com. Unfortunately, the potential president had johnedwards.com, so I had to put my middle name in there. So it's johnmichaeledwards.com.
How about a message for our listeners?
Thank you for listening, and I hope you visit my website and follow the rest of my career.
Is there anything we have missed that we should have asked you, or anything about your career that you would like to say or give a plug to somebody?
I think you're such a genius, you covered everything.
Oh, that's a first, John. Thank you so much.
Okay, folks, I'm here at Spa with Stefano Coletti. Stefano, good to meet you. How are you today?
Hi, good. Weather is perfect, so couldn't be better.
How do you like this track? Is there anything as exciting as Spa?
Well, there is. It's one of the nicest tracks in the world. I mean, you can ask any driver, he will tell you the same. I think between slow corners and fast corners here, you have a mixture of everything, and it's very exciting to race here.
Now, I understand it was your mom who took you to a karting track for the first time. What do you remember most from your first experience in a kart?
First time I went on a go-kart was when I was 7, and it was my mom who actually brought me there because some friends were doing karting. So I went there and I tried, and since I tried, I never wanted to stop. And my dad never wanted me to start racing, so for 2 years I tried to convince him, and in the end it was my mom who pushed him to make me do it. So I have to say thank you to my mom.
Now, your last name is Italian, and your dad was still not interested in racing? That's surprising.
No, the thing is, he used to be a lot involved into Formula One a few years back, and he knew how difficult this universe was, so he didn't want me to get involved, but in the end, you know, he couldn't do anything when I was asking him and begging him for 2 years in a row every day that I wanted to drive, so he just made me start.
Great. In 2004, you won the European Championship and the prestigious Margutti Trophy. Tell us a little bit about these achievements, and who was the competition back in your karting days?
Well, it was. I did all my karting career with more or less all the guys that are racing with me now. I mean, Laimer, Calado, Bianchi, it's all the guys that were racing against me. And when I won the European Championships, I actually won it in front of Bianchi, who's second, and Calado, who is third. So the level was already really high then. And I mean, I had a hell of a time at that time. It was really good. Karting was really nice. And I miss it a bit. I have to be honest, karting was nice. So, but you know, you have to go forward in a career, so you have to go do racing.
Let me ask you a question. What do you learn most in karting that helps you in automobile racing? Or in other words, can you become a good driver without much karting experience?
I don't think you can now nowadays, because karting teaches you a lot, especially in how to fight and how to overtake. And there's a lot of fighting going on in karting, and I think that if you don't go through there, you don't have the basics. So it's a step you need to go through if you want to race cars.
You mentioned Laimer and Bianchi. Were they very, and Calado, were they also very quick in karting?
They were already. I mean, Calado was two years in a row finished third in the European Championship. And Laimer was also very quick. Bianchi was always really, really quick in karting. So they were always already fast since we're kids. I mean, the competition was already there. And it's nice to actually see that we're fighting against the same people arriving in GP2. You know, it's quite good.
Okay, next 2 years you raced in Formula BMW. What was the biggest challenge you faced adjusting from karting to single-seater racing?
It was difficult, to be honest. My first year was kind of a disaster, but I had a lot of problems with my team, and I couldn't get used to the racing world. I mean, the bigger cars, and it wasn't easy, but I have to say that it was a lot of learning. Because in that year I started a lot of times in the back, so I had to always make good starts and fight a lot in the first few laps and know how to go through the accidents and everything. So it was, I think, a good year to learn. and then immediately in the second year everything started to go much better. So
now in 2006 you had a great time racing in America, 3 wins and a podium finish in 4 races. What was your impression of American racing scene, tracks and fans?
Well, it's a different world, you know. Fans are much more integrated into the racing world, because if you go in the paddock in the States, there's a lot of people in the paddock. So when you go in the paddock in Europe, there is no one. The paddock is pretty close to the public. So in that level, it's much more open for the people to watch, and I think it's nicer for them. And the atmosphere, it's completely different in here. It's, let's say, much more relaxed. Everyone is more friendly than in Europe. Europe is a lot more serious than over there. So it has the good sides and the bad sides.
Okay, and talking on the good side, which one was your choice? Hot dogs or cheeseburgers?
Cheeseburgers, definitely.
Very good. Okay, that's a standard question we ask for all drivers who come to America. Okay, any desire to race in any car someday or NASCAR?
For sure. It's an interesting series. It's one of my first choice after, of course, Formula One. I mean, if I can't get through to F1 for any reasons, my first choice would be IndyCar. So, and I loved, I would love to race in the States anyway. Even if I have a good career here, for sure, it would. I would love to go race there on an after career. You know, the States. I always liked the States. I almost went there when I was younger after BMW and after Renault. I wanted to go there to do a Formula Atlantic, but then things changed and I stayed in Europe. But it's an environment that I really like, and I wouldn't put it on the side. I think it would be, like I said, another choice. If I can't make it to Formula One, for sure I will try to make it to IndyCar.
Okay, great. Now, before GP2, you have also raced in Formula Renault 2-liter, Formula 3, and World Series by Renault. Which series, in your opinion, was the best learning experience?
Well, let's say that Formula 3 and Formula Renault 3.5 are categories where you drive a lot, where the cars are not easy to drive, especially Formula 3 car. And as I said, you take a lot of mileage, you have a lot of driving experience, so it's good for a young driver to go through these categories, because when you're young, you need to make a lot of laps to learn. So, for example, World Series gives you 2.5 hours of practice on a Friday, so it was a good series, good step to go through World Series before coming to GP2, I think.
And in Formula 3, it was in Formula 3, if I remember correctly, that you and Jules Bianchi played a little let's get physical. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, it was just a little bit of too much talking after a podium, so we ended up with the hands. But it wasn't. I mean, we were young and stupid, and I think we all learned from our mistakes. And now we're back to be friends, so everything is fine.
That's good.
Welcome back to F1 Weekly. Steve Faub here, your host, sitting in for Clark Rogers. And now into the quick wrap-up. We're going to forego email this week due to the length of our wonderful Bobby Answer interview. And there are a few messages here. We are now out of XL, extra large, limited edition F1 Weekly t-shirts. We still have small, medium, and larges. Plus, if you purchase a t-shirt, you get a free 2007 Motorsports Memories Dynamic Duels calendar. Lots of wonderful pictures suitable for framing. And Clark will return this weekend to join me for both the qualification and Turkish Grand Prix wrap-ups. If you would like to advertise or cross-promote with our website or podcast, please email us at info@f1weekly.com. Nasser, parting comments?
Question for you, Yahoo Ads. Who do you think is going to win the Turkish Grand Prix?
Robert Kubica.
You never know. It will happen one day.
I'm sure that he will have several victories in his pocket before he retires is forced out of Formula One. A lot of it, too, depends on if he can maintain his ride at BMW. He'll definitely have wins.
My money, 2 pesos, 2 rupees, 2 dinars, or Finnish krona is on Kimi Raikkonen.
Kimi? Yeah, the track is suited well to the long wheelbase of the Ferrari, so they should have a good weekend. And with the turmoil going on at McLaren, I have a feeling there's going to be other issues.
And we would love to hear from our listeners, Yahoos and other listeners in Turkey, if they go to the event, send us some scoop, you know, how the event was, what's going on.
Yeah, just give us kind of an overview of what happened. Maybe send us some photos if you have them available. That'd be nice. I would like to see pictures of the track. Good night, and we'll see you this weekend.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is Desiree for F1Weekly.com, thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast. reporting and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport, a blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs.